This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies and in Literature, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Minnie Sawney, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Alvaro Santana Acuña, who's a sociologist and historian and currently teaches sociology at Whitman College. He received his MA in Social Sciences from the University of Chicago and PhD in Sociology from Harvard University. His essays have appeared in The Atlantic, Time Magazine, El País, El Mundo, and Nexos, among other media. We are here today to discuss a book which has had abiding success for the past 55 years. The book is titled 100 Years of Solitude, and Alvaro's book on it is titled Ascent to Glory, How 100 Years of Solitude was written and became a global classic. It's been published by Columbia University Press in August 2020. Dr. Alvaro, to begin, perhaps we could talk about your own trajectory and the genesis of this book. Right at the end, you tell us that though working on 100 Years of Solitude was something you might have wanted to do, a day of interminable rain in Boston helped you decide when you couldn't get Macondo and its rain out of your mind. So tell us first about your own career, how you've been plowing the sea, arando el mar, a term I laughingly used to describe your trajectory, and what led you to write this much-needed tome, which is a kind of sociology of the novel rather than a literary analysis.
Yeah, thank you, Minnie. It's a pleasure to be with you. So thank you for the invitation to talk about my book. I'm happy to address the first question. So as you know, I'm originally from the Canary Islands in Spain. Right now, actually very much in the news because there is a volcano active in the island of La Palma. So, and I grew up there, and the Canaries is a very interesting place because it's in the middle of Europe, Africa, and Latin America, right? So the Canaries are located off the coast of Morocco. So historically, it has always had this beautiful connection to Europe because the Spaniards conquered the Canaries right at the time when Columbus got to the Americas. And then geographically, the Canaries are in Africa. And historically, as I said, it has been this area you need to go through if you wanted to reach the Americas for almost 400 years. So then the culture of the Canaries is very much tri-continental culture. And we're actually discussing, Minnie, before the interview that in the last also 50 years, there has been a very important Indian community living in the Canaries as well, right? So it has been a very cosmopolitan place ever since it was conquered. And Latin American culture is very present also in the Canary Islands. So when I was little kid, García Márquez, the author of One Year of Solitude, was actually already a very important author. And in high school in Spain, it's very usual that you read his works. So, and in my case, I remember reading one of his first short stories. Well, actually, not one of the first, but it was the first I read. It's a short story from the 1960s, The Most Beautiful Drawn Man, which I read as part of an anthology of short stories by García Márquez, Cortázar, Borges, Edgar Allan Poe, Faulkner, Gogol. And I remember reading that short story. I really liked it. I especially liked the title, but I must say that I like other short stories better. And then a few years later, I read also No One Writes to the Colonel, a very impressive book, which I read in my late years in high school. And that certainly was a book that I was really shocked by it, because it tells the story, this tragic story of this senior member of the army, the Colombian army, waiting for decades to receive his pension. So, and then I went on. I did my BA in history locally in the University of La Laguna, and then I finished my BA. And to be honest with you, I wasn't really thinking about literature as something I wanted to study. I was primarily a consumer of literature. I have always been, and I really like learning new languages so I can read literary texts in the original language. And then I went on to started my PhD in history, but then I decided I want to stop it. And then I did my MA in the social sciences at the University of Chicago, as you mentioned. And there I started to interact with a lot of colleagues in the Romance Languages and Literatures Department, especially my colleague Mario Santana, who is actually from the Canaries, no relation, just that we are both from the Canaries. And there I was interacting with a lot of colleagues who were interested in Latin American literature. And I realized that I actually have read a lot of literature and also a lot of studies about how some of these works of literature became so important. And to my surprise, I find myself having these really wonderful and deep conversations about Latin American literature. But it didn't go beyond that until the following year, I started my PhD at Harvard. And I remember the fall of 2007 was really rainy. It was my first time living in Cambridge, and it was raining one day after the other. And then one day after, you know, like several days almost of nonstop rain, I was walking to the library, and then out of nowhere, I was hit by the thought that I expressed out loud. Oh, wow, it rains like in Macondo, right? And at the moment, you know, for those of you who have not read the novel, you know, Macondo is the village where the story of One Year of Solitude takes place. And at a certain moment in the story, it rains a lot, right, for a very long time, right? So this has become actually a very famous episode in the novel. And then when I said, whoa, it rains like in Macondo, it has already been like probably 15 years after I have read the novel, never really went back to it, except for, you know, having conversations with, you know, colleagues about Latin American literature. And also at that time, I had not visited Latin America, right? So it's not that, so that me citing that sentence didn't have a connection to the region. So I wonder why I did that. Why did I make that connection between the rain in Cambridge and the rain in the novel? And to my surprise, that was the beginning of my research, even though I didn't start the project until a year later, when I was talking to my advisor, and then we were thinking about potential topics that I wanted to work on my for my PhD. And that's when I started thinking about the possibility that maybe I wanted to work on how works of art and cultural objects at large become classics, because, you know, at the time I felt that there was not, the literature I was reading, I was not fully happy with the answers that they were giving to this question, mostly because in sociology, my colleagues want to answer that question from a sociological angle, and then historians from a historical angle, and then my colleagues in literary studies from a literary studies angle. So what I tried to do in the book was precisely to merge these three disciplines and then provide an interdisciplinary study in which I would address that question. And then also, as you mentioned, that this was also, empirically speaking, this was also a book that was very much needed, because research on classics, and especially on One Year of Solitude, is full of myths and legends, right? And I'm not, in the book, I'm not denying that myths and legends are necessary. So one of the arguments I make is that we really need to have myths and legends as part of the classics. In other words, let us think about a classic book that is not in one way surrounded by a myth or a legend, right? So then 100 of Solitude is certainly surrounded by these myths and legends. And why is that important? Well, because also, if you really want to study how this novel was written, or first of all, how it was conceived and then written and then became a global classic, as I do in my book, you really need to, first of all, look beyond the myths and legends that surround this novel. And that, of course, require me a lot of research. So going to the original source instead of relying on secondary sources that maybe are more prone to follow or repeat some of these legends. So to really understand and get as close as possible to the primary sources. And that was a very long process. That was over a decade of research. And the book, you know, came out about a year ago.
Okay, let's talk about the book a little. In your book, you deconstruct the fake news, as you've called it, about the success of the book and how it amassed its cult following. You deny that there is any single recipe to turn a work of art into a classic. And in pages that make fascinating reading, you say that many of the myths surrounding the book are things that Garcia Marquez was party to. In the end, as you point out, based on a lot of evidence, it was the cultural brokers, the literally cognoscenti and fellow writers of the boom, the ones you call the gatekeepers, the Spanish publishing industry and the Casa de las Americas, who made the success of 100 Years of Solitude possible. You return to this point of the literary forebears of Garcia Marquez many times. Give us a brief summary of the book and tell us about how the novel is an example of collective construction, as well as the cultural brokers in the field of cultural production, because I think this fact will be of news to many of its fans, and I'm talking in particular about India as well. It's been, you know, reviewed in Calcutta, which was till recently a left-leaning state, as well as Kerala, which has a left government. So these fans of Garcia Marquez are not generally people from literature. So what you're saying could take them a little by surprise as well. So explain to us this point about cultural brokers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Mini. So Ascent to Glory is two books in one, in a way, because the first part of the book looks at the imagination and production of the novel. In other words, how Garcia Marquez was capable of imagining a novel like this, and then how he actually wrote it. So, and to do that, I do several things. So the first one is to really investigate, and this is something that sociologists have not done often, which is to study what I call the stage of imagination. In other words, what are the conditions that makes it possible for an artist to imagine a certain work of art? And why is that important? Well, because we know, and this is not just something that happens to artists, it happens to people writing papers, right, and you know, having projects that sometimes you have an idea for a project, and then you keep it there for a certain amount of time, and eventually that project is not executed, right? It's not done. So, you know, renovation of something at home, or you know, a paper that you're writing, or an idea for a work of art. Right. So, but that happens all the time. So we imagine things, right? As I say in the book, we human beings are imagineros, right? Not in the sense of, you know, the classic meaning of that word in Spanish, but that we have the capacity of imagining things. However, imagination is also a social kind of action, and which means that sure, we can imagine certain things, but I don't think that, say, for instance, ancient Romans were capable of imagining rockets and to occupy Mars, for instance, right? So imagination is deeply historical and social, right? So then historical conditions and social conditions makes it possible for us to imagine certain things and not others. So what I do in the first part of the book is actually to try to understand what was going on in García Márquez's life in Colombia and in Latin America at large, to really understand what made it possible for him to imagine a novel such as 100 Years of Solitude. And for that, one of the things that I do is, for instance, to track the origins of the label Latin American literature, Literatura Latinoamericana. Why? Because this was not a label that was around for a long time. This was a way of talking about Latin American literature that emerged in the 1940s and then became extremely important in the 1960s. And it really helped many of the writers in the region to really start thinking about what they were doing as a new kind of literature, right? So, and that was really important to help them to start imagining that what they were writing was not simply, say, Argentine literature or Colombian literature, but more broadly, Latin American literature. And this happened when García Márquez was growing up and coming out of age as a professional writer. So he really absorb all that enthusiasm about the region being able to produce its own literature. And then, of course, another thing that I do is to explain how he started to acquire the professional skills that were necessary for him to write fiction in the first place. And I talk about his training in journalism, how he learned from the craft of journalism techniques to write stories, right? Also, he's working cinema. Not many people know that García Márquez was very interested in cinema, and he was actually a film critic for a long time. He collaborated also with colleagues in the making of films in Colombia as a scriptwriter. Then also he went on to study montage in Italy. So he was really interested in what is it that cinema can teach us about the cinematic storytelling. And then another important area in which he was also learning skills, professional skills that he applied to his literary work, was marketing. And that was that may actually come across as a surprise for many García Márquez or even, you know, people working in literature or just people interested in artists at large, because we don't actually think about marketing. And yet García Márquez, like many of his colleagues, was doing marketing, and he was learning skills about how to market things to the public. And this public was not a public that had already existed in Latin America in the 1960s. And more broadly in Europe, we have the emergence of the reading middle classes. In other words, we have the paperback revolution happening in the UK, in Spain, in the United States, in France, and of course in Latin America. Why? Well, because the reading was becoming a new habit of the middle classes. There was also an expanding higher education system in all these countries. So García Márquez realized when he was writing for marketing that he was learning the skills of how I can talk in a specific way to specific audiences. And that was also another important area in which he learned skills. And then the final one that I talk about in the book, of course, is the usual suspect literature. So what is that he learned from Faulkner, from Hemingway, from Wolfe, from some of the Colombian writers, some of them historical ones, some of them contemporaries. So what were the skills that he learned? So he was profoundly influenced then by Anglo-American modernism, as well as Golden Age literature from the 17th century Spain, like the age of Don Quixote, as well as some of the contemporary poets like Pablo Neruda, García Lorca, Gómez de la Serna, Cepeda Zamudio, his friend in Colombia, Salamea Borda, right? So a whole range of authors he was reading. And also to address another point that you make in your question, he was not acquiring all these skills in isolation. And that's another thing that is really important. So García Márquez, from really early on, developed the habit of talking about his work with colleagues and peers and friends and professionals in the publishing sector. So then from his very first novel, he was circulating the manuscripts among people who could really give him feedback. And that also happened with 100 Days of Solitude, which was a book that he wrote with the help of many people. Of course, he was writing that book in his room in isolation, in solitude, so to speak. But he was also having this really extraordinary amount of interaction with people via mail, right? So in the 1960s, air travel became cheaper, and then air mail was quite affordable. So he was having, like today we have almost day-to-day conversations or permanent conversations with colleagues via email. So he was also having these conversations via mail with colleagues in France, in Spain, in the UK, and Colombia, Argentina. And also phone calls. He was also talking to people about what he was actually doing. And then people in his inner circle, people who would actually come and check on the progress of the novel. Some of them would actually come to his place almost every night because they were close friends. They would be just having, you know, a couple of drinks, eating something, and then they would ask him also, how is the novel going? And then he would tell them, they would give him feedback. So to capture this collective construction of the novel, in the book I use the term networked creativity, right? So to really show how creativity is not just the work of a single individual, but is really part of a network phenomenon, right? In which we can really, in the case of 100 of Solitude, we can really trace and we can see the influence of all these friends and colleagues and peers, the influence that they had in the imagination or on the imagination of the writer and in the actual production of the novel. So that's where pretty much the first part of the book ends. I also write about the actual production of the novel, the contracts, the different options that he had on the table, how he physically wrote the novel, how many words he was writing every day, the different characters, different options, right? And how the different characters, different options were influenced by his network. And then the early reception. And here, one of the interesting findings, and I'm sure that we will certainly have a chance to talk more about magical realism, is that today, 100 of Solitude is perceived as the classic novel of magical realism. This is a style that merges descriptions of real life with magical events, right? So magical realism has become a genre that transcends literature. So it's something that we find in movies. So for instance, you know, the movies of Guillermo del Toro, right? The Shape of Water, right? So Hollywood or The Life of Pi, right? So very successful films. And also in the arts at large, you know, ballet and theater. So it's really now a genre in its own. What is very interesting is that 100 Days of Solitude is perceived now globally as the style that or as a novel that helped to develop this style. And to be honest with you, one of the things that I found while doing the research is that no one, except for one critic, said that One Year of Solitude was magical realism when the novel was released. Right? So there's a really very interesting process that I study. Is that, okay, how is it then that 100 Years of Solitude became and was turned into a magical realist novel? And that's one of the things I explore also in the second part of the book, in which I write about how this novel became a global classic. And there, what I do is to really try to find as many references as possible that can explain to us how different audiences in different cultures, in different countries. So you mentioned India, for instance, right? So there are actually references about India. So how different audiences and different organizations have appropriated One Year of Solitude and then turn it into a classic. And for that, I introduced the notion of cultural brokers, which you mentioned in your question, which what I want to do with that notion is to really expand beyond the traditional view of becoming a canonical, or actually even more, a classic book. There's a tendency to think about that something becomes classic because it's something that is set by scholars or set by literary critics. And yeah, sure, they are very important, and they are important contributors to the consecration of a work of art, of something becoming classic. But at the same time, we also need to take into account what other cultural brokers, right? And that includes, you know, celebrities, politicians, revolutionaries, priests, other artists, and common readers, right? And what I do in the book, in the second part, is precisely to trace how different cultural brokers in all continents, including Antarctica. I found a reference about someone reading 100 of Solitude in the Antarctica, right? So how is it that all the different, this vast constellation of cultural brokers have appropriated the novel and then appropriated parts of the novel and make sense of it as something that becomes meaningful for them. So they recall then parts of the book. And that's really interesting because it's an ongoing process. So it's not something that it stops, but rather I tend to think about the classic as an ongoing contract. And why do I say that? Well, because one of the ways in which we can see that this process is ongoing, for instance, that Disney has just released a movie I have not watched, but it's a Colombian-based movie called Encanto. And to my surprise, one of the elements that it's on the cover, the poster for the film are yellow butterflies. And this is an image that comes from One Year of Solitude, something that has become a cultural reference around the world, right? So one of the ways in which also cultural brokers around the world connect to the novel. And maybe, you know, what's going to happen is that many kids, many hundreds of people are going to actually want to watch this movie, and they don't know that the yellow butterflies come from One Year of Solitude. And yet they may actually love that, they may dislike that, but they're going to expose to something that has traveled beyond the book and then has entered a Disney movie. And this you know, a really beautiful example of how elements from the novel are appropriated by a cultural broker, in this case Disney, and then gives it another life. And what I do in the book is basically to look at many of these examples and then to explain how the appropriation takes place.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, we go on to the next question. Now, his peers ascribed, Garcia Marquez's peers ascribed to themselves and also gave him the label of cosmopolitan Latin American writer, because unlike writers such as Arguedas, he drew US writers like Faulkner into the Latin American orbit. So they also said it's not a collection of national literatures, but a literary tradition built on the existence of a Latin American nation, as you also said right in the beginning. Initially, as you say, he was fit into the category of rural cosmopolitanism. Later, his book was described as a Gothic novel in the tropics. And it seems that the novel managed to fit in various categories that were reigning trends. Tell us about Garcia Marquez's signature style of magical realism, which you already have, and you've also talked about the imagination. But what I'd like you to emphasize now is what it signified and what was his skillful use of language that adapted to the various epochs described in the book. That's quite a marvel in 100 Years of Solitude, which you yourself have drawn attention to. So maybe you can answer the last part.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's also a very important question, because as I was briefly mentioning before, so Garcia Marquez wrote 100 Years of Solitude in between 1965 and 1967, and by then he had already written other books, three novels and a book of short stories. And when you look at the reception of his early work, what is really striking is that even though all of the elements that we see later on in 100 Years of Solitude are already there, including what later on became known as magical realism, what is really interesting is that critics and readers did not perceive that as magical realism, not even as Latin American literature, right? Because as I said before, in the 1950s and 60s, there was this ongoing process by which books produced in different countries were elevated to a new category, a new way of thinking about them as Latin American literature. So what was really interesting is that Garcia Marquez in his first years was not perceived by critics as a Latin American writer, but primarily as a Colombian writer, as a very young and talented Colombian writer, and also someone who was very attached to things about the countryside, the rural, and the violence in the rural areas, right? And what is quite remarkable is then, at the beginning of the 1960s, literary critics like Angel Rama, for instance, a classic critic who was really into, so he really wanted to develop a new way of thinking about the literature in your region as being something beyond national boundaries. So I started to read works by Garcia Marquez and by some of his contemporaries as not simply being works of Colombian literature. Of course, it was Colombian literature, but it was something more. And so was the case of Fuentes' literature, Vargas Llosa's literature, even Borges' literature. So the critics did really a very nice job in terms of trying to find something that connected all these works of literature beyond the national. And one of the things that happened is that in a matter of 2-3 years, Garcia Marquez stopped being labeled a rural Colombian writer, or even, you know, some kind of Gothic or phantasmagoric, as one critic put it, a writer. And instead, it was reinterpreted as a rising voice of the new Latin American novel, right? So he was basically being turned, relabeled as a Latin American writer, right? And that was also very important because García Márquez was reading what these critics were actually writing, see? And then a very interesting thing happened also in his brain is that he started to realize that, oh, well, maybe this is actually what I then the way I need to conceive my works has to be Latin American, right? So One Hour of Solitude then is a novel in which he more purposely, right? So we're basically now talking about the imagination being shaped by literary criticism at the time. So he consciously then tried to write 100 of Solitude as something that was also Latin American. So he was more aware of what he was writing before was not just simply Colombian, but Latin America. And then also his entire work prior to 100 of Solitude was reinterpreted as that. And that was amazing, right? Because he really operated this wonderful transformation in his imagination. And then he started to produce that novel and he surrounded himself by people who were also partisans of this new Latin American novel movement, right? Including Fuentes and Donoso and other critics like Rodriguez Monegal. So, and at the same time, to go back to the point that you were making, is that also he changed the language, right? So what is very remarkable is that for a long time, García Márquez was really struggling with writing fiction in the way that he wanted. So the Leaf Storm, his first novel, No One Writes to the Colonel, In Evil Hour, are novels in which he's using a very succinct economic language, especially in Evil Hour and No One Writes to the Colonel, a language that is very close to that of Hemingway. So he was really trying to write with very straight, precise, concise sentences. And he was, you know, he was happy about that, but at the same time he was frustrated because he wanted to do other things, right? And he found a way to do that in his journalism. What is really quite remarkable is that the best literary writing of García Márquez before One Day of Solitude is also present in his journalism in the late 1950s, in which he was writing about current events in Venezuela and in Latin America. And he was using this literary style mixed with journalism. And that was part of actually a very interesting trend going on. It's called New Journalism, in which you mix literature with journalism. And you read some of his articles, some of his reportages, and they're deeply literary. Yeah? So then what happened is that when he started writing 100 of Solitude, he merged both, right? So he wanted to use the language of Hemingway, which is still there a little bit, but also mix it with this more flamboyant literary language that he was actually using in his journalism. And the result is 100 of Solitude. He really found a style, a language that he really wanted to use that also complied with the requirements of what a successful new Latin American novel should be. See, and that was a very big discovery for him, and he was really happy about that. And of course, once the novel was released, many critics praised it immediately as a great work of the new Latin American literature, what later on was relabeled as the Latin American boom in literature.
Now, notwithstanding all the luck and success, there have also been critiques of the novel. As you've said in your book, Macondism, which is a view of Latin America, is undeveloped and with which the novel is said to have propagated. And there have been various important detractors whose names you mention, and they've called it overvalued and said that its frothy Baroque prose is unreadable. Despite this, its success continues. Tell us about this phenomenon, about all the critiques that it received, and yet the fact that it continued to be a success, a roaring success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also a very important point, because when we're thinking about classics, we tend to think about classics as works that receive kind of a general positive reaction to them. And when I was doing my research, I was struck by, because I was certainly not just working on 100 of Solids, I was also reading literature about other classics. And something that was really striking to me was to find out how many critics of Shakespeare there have been, and you know, some of them are still up and running, so writing nasty things about Shakespeare, right? So, and I'm not talking about, you know, just ordinary readers. I'm also talking about very important and even classic authors such as Voltaire, the 18th century French philosopher. He wrote very critical texts about Shakespeare. Also, Tolstoy, the 19th century Russian writer, wrote an entire book trashing, criticizing Shakespeare's works. Virginia Woolf, the famous 20th century modernist writer, also had, you know, some criticism of Shakespeare, right? So if you actually then think about it, then Shakespeare also has a really distinguished history of critics. And that was, for me, a really interesting finding, because when I was doing the research, I was certainly coming across wonderful praise for the novel, right? So in saying that 100 of Solitude was a masterful work and an unparalleled success and an outstanding piece of fiction. But at the same time, I was also coming across a lot of criticism, and I wasn't sure how to make sense of that until I realized that these were not just single individuals at a particular moment, but I was also seeing a pattern in different cultures, in different nations, in different languages, in different periods, by different kinds of publics, right? So then I realized that there is also a social pattern, right, that helps a book to become a classic, which is criticism, or what I call entrenched criticism. And that's very important. That was a very important finding in my book, right? That entrenched criticism is also a very important pattern in the making of classic books, right? So, you know, to put it simply, you know, there is no better publicity than bad publicity, and that also helps a book to become really important over time. Another pattern. So I just talk about the important pattern of criticism, but there are other patterns that are also really crucial, such as, for instance, lived experience. So something that we also do with the classics is to connect them to our life, like everyday experiences, right? So you read the book or you have heard of the book, and then you find a connection between the book and something that's happening to you. And that's precisely what happened to me when I started my research, which was to connect my experience of something that I read in the novel, The Rain in Macondo, to something that was occurring to me real time in Cambridge. And then another thing that was very important is the pattern of artistic commensuration. In other words, comparing this work to other works of art. So then you establish that comparison to say, okay, which one is better? So that is also a pattern to compare 100 of Solitude to other classics, to other works of art. And then another also interesting pattern is that of universalization, right? Which is that there's a tendency to think about books that are classics or books that are somehow universal. They speak to this interesting concept of universal human nature. And that has also happened to 100 of Solitude. It's been transformed into a book that that cultural brokers say that, you know, has that connection to human nature. You know, as a sociologist, you know, and a historian, I don't believe in a universal human nature. But for me, what is really interesting is to see how that is also a pattern by which books and works of art large are turned into classics.
Uh-huh. Okay, now finally, let's end by talking about your writing about this book. The multitudinous references and sources you have deployed, and the years it took you to glean this wealth of information. And you're also curating an exhibition of Garcia Marquez at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas in Austin. So all this is probably all, you know, your research on the book has probably led you to this curating activity as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Mini. You're right. So this is actually a book for which I was using multiple sources, precisely because I was at the beginning. I didn't want to rely on secondary sources. I wanted to go to the primary sources. And for the first part of the book, I was using sources from García Márquez's personal archives at the Harry Ramson Center, which is this amazing cultural institution, a museum, a research center, and also an archive that keeps the archives of and works of art of many important artists of the last, you know, like 500 years, and actually also have items from previous epochs. So they bought the archives of García Márquez, and they have made them available to researchers. And I was one of the lucky researchers who got to receive a fellowship from the Ramson Center through the Mellon Foundation, and then work on the archives of García Márquez. And I did a lot of interesting findings, to the point that when I got to the Ramson Center, I thought the book was already written. I had already written most of the book, and then I realized that I had to rewrite most of it, so to align with many of the findings. And that's the moment when I realized that many of the secondary sources were reproducing some of these legends and myths. And then for the second part of the book, I really took advantage of Harvard University's outstanding book and collection. So I was able to dig really deep into from the 1967 up until now. So find as many references to the novel as possible to collect all this kind of big data database of references to the novel. So then I was able to find these patterns, right? And of course, then I also went online, and then I looked at, you know, all kinds of sources of information. So in that, because I really want to produce this texture, right? So I really wanted to give a sense to the readers in the book of the breadth and of references to the novel across so many different audiences and places and countries. So to really show this process of global consecration, right? And then to my surprise, to my happy surprise, I was also writing articles to precisely share some of the findings in my research with non-academic audiences. So pieces for the New Yorker, so for the New York Times, the Atlantic, El País in Spain. And then, you know, the Ramson Center also invited me to curate the first exhibition of García Márquez's work with the archives. And that was a wonderful experience. So it was also a way of conveying some of the findings in the book in a different way and to broader audiences. And that was a wonderful experience. So the exhibition is still open and until January 2nd. And I certainly invite listeners to go to Austin if they can before January 2nd. And if not, then also Mexico City in June of 2022, the exhibition would open in Mexico City.
Okay, so thank you very much, Alvaro, for your time and for telling us all about this book. And I hope your book as well finds the same kind of resonance that 100 Years of Solitude has done.
Thank you so much, Mini. It has been a real pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much.